from New York, this is Democracy Now!
What the hell are we doing here? What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again whipping black people, Haitians, into the water where they're scrambling and falling down when all they're trying to do is escape from violence in their country.
The U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti resigns in protest over the Biden administration's mass deportation of Haitian asylum seekers, days after U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback were filmed chasing, grabbing, and whipping refugees at the border. We'll speak with Congressmember Maxine Waters, longtime advocate of the people of Haiti. But first, as the Delta variant continues to surge across the United States, so too has the housing and eviction crisis, with more than 11 million households now behind on rent. Most of those evicted, Black and Latinx. The majority are single women with children.
I've been forced to choose between food, rent, too many times. Many of us had to make the choice of the choices between our health or our homes. The rent eats first.
That ain't right.
We'll speak with a single mother and with a high school student who faced eviction and went to Washington, D.C. to help Congressmember Cori Bush and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduce the Keeping Renters Safe Act to reinstate the federal pandemic eviction moratorium. Then the Taliban are already restricting women's rights just a month since they took over Afghanistan. We'll speak with V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, founder of 1 Billion Rising, which has organized mass actions for Saturday to roar and rage for the women in Afghanistan. And we'll hear from a recent member of Afghan parliament who's now in an undisclosed location.
Indisputably, we believe where there is oppression, there is resistance that will begin and grow against it. The resistance has been initiated by women. Fortunately, this time, women took the lead.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti has resigned in protest over the Biden administration's policies. In a letter, the longtime diplomat Daniel Foote wrote, quote, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees." Foote also criticized the Biden administration for meddling in Haiti's political affairs, including its support for Ariel Henry as Haiti's prime minister following the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse in July. Foote wrote, quote, "The cycle of international political interventions in Haiti has consistently produced catastrophic results." Foote's resignation came just days after U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback were filmed chasing, grabbing, and whipping Haitian asylum seekers who'd gathered in a makeshift camp in Del Rio, Texas. On Thursday, the Department of Homeland Security banned the use of horses in the area, but deportations continued despite growing criticism from human rights advocates. The New York Times reports the Biden administration has now deported nearly 2,000 Haitians since last week. About 3,000 Haitians remain in the makeshift camps in Del Rio, while thousands of others have been allowed to stay in the United States. Immigrant justice activists held demonstrations across the United States yesterday to demand the closure of all Immigration and Customs Enforcement jails, an end to deportations, and the release of all imprisoned asylum seekers and immigrants. The Communities Not Cages Day of Action came as reports show the number of people detained by ICE has gone up 70% since President Biden took office. In Atlanta, activists rallied in front of the Stewart County Detention Center. This is LGBTQ plus activist Leanne Sanchez of the group Community Estrella, who was held in three different immigration jails, including Irwin County Detention Center, which was forced to shut down due to whistleblower complaints of medical abuses like forced hysterectomies.
Viene a mi mente momentos I have unpleasant memories of all the unhealthy and inhumane conditions in these places of torture, the medical negligence and the unsanitary food, but the worst was having to stay in solitary confinement for a whole year in the infamous hole, just because I am trans, because they don't have a dedicated place to hold LGBT people.
Centers for Disease Control Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky has endorsed giving workers in high-risk settings booster vaccine shots despite opposition from a CDC panel. On Thursday, the panel recommended making Pfizer-BioNTech booster shots available to people 65 and older, nursing home residents, and people with underlying health conditions. But the panel did not recommend booster shots for younger healthcare workers, teachers, and other high-risk settings. But Walensky then overruled the panel. Many global health experts have criticized the Biden administration for promoting booster shots while much of the world remains unvaccinated. At the United Nations General Assembly, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa repeated his call for waiving intellectual property rights on vaccines. He also criticized wealthy nations for hoarding vaccines.
It is an indictment on humanity that more than 82% of the world's vaccine doses have been acquired by wealthy countries, while less than 1% has gone to low-income countries. Unless we address this as a matter of urgency, the pandemic will last much longer and new mutations of the virus will emerge and spread. South Africa reaffirms its call for fair and equitable distribution of vaccines.
Meanwhile, Bolivian President Luis Arce said access to vaccines should be considered a human right in his address to the UN General Assembly.
Capitalism has commodified all aspects of social life, and health is not the exception. Medical science should be at the service of humanity without any sort of geographical, political, social, or nationality discrimination. The access to the vaccine must be considered as a human right.
The UN General Assembly is taking place as COVID cases continue to surge in parts of the world. Earlier today, South Korea reported over 2,400 new COVID cases, its highest daily tally since the start of the pandemic. In Yemen, Oxfam is warning COVID deaths have increased fivefold in the past month. Fewer than 1% of Yemen's population is vaccinated. At the United Nations, leaders from low-lying and island nations have also called on wealthy countries to do far more to combat the climate emergency. This is the Guyanese president, Irfan Ali.
Small island states and continental countries with low-lying coastlines, such as Guyana, will be the first to feel the full brunt of the impending disaster. Yet our countries are among the lowest emitters of greenhouse gas emissions, contributing the least to the harmful and destructive effects of climate change. This is not only unfair, it is unjust.
In other climate news, the Environmental Protection Agency has issued a new rule to cut the use of hydrofluorocarbons, highly potent greenhouse gases commonly used in air conditioning and refrigeration. Meanwhile, youth climate activists are staging a global climate strike today with actions planned in over 1,500 locations. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved increasing the Pentagon's budget, even though the U.S. recently pulled combat troops out of Afghanistan, ending the longest war in U.S. history. On Thursday, a bipartisan group of lawmakers voted in support of a $768 billion Pentagon budget as part of the National Defense Authorization Act. This was $25 billion more than President Biden sought. The House rejected two amendments to trim the Pentagon's budget and an amendment to prohibit the military from transferring firearms, military vehicles, and aircraft to local police departments. House lawmakers, however, did approve an amendment to end all U.S. support for the Saudi-led bombing of Yemen. California Congressmember Ro Khanna had introduced the amendment.
Our amendment would end all U.S. logistical support and transfer of spare parts for Saudi warplanes that are bombing Yemen, that are bombing schools, that are killing children, that are bombing civilians in the largest humanitarian crisis around the world.
House lawmakers have also voted to approve $1 billion in new military funds for Israel, despite accusations from human rights groups that Israel committed war crimes during its recent assault on Gaza. The congressional funding is being given to help Israel replenish its Iron Dome missile defense system, which is built in part by the U.S. military contractor Raytheon. 8 Democrats voted against the measure, including Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, the first Palestinian-American congresswoman.
I rise in opposition to this supplemental. I will not support an effort to enable and support war crimes, human rights abuses, and violence. We cannot be talking only about Israelis' need for safety at a time when Palestinians are living under a violent apartheid system and are dying from what Human Rights Watch has said are war crimes. We should also be talking about Palestinian need for security from Israeli attacks. We must be consistent in our commitment to human life, period. Everyone deserves to be safe there.
Catalan separatist leader Carles Puigdemont has been detained in Italy on an arrest warrant from Spain, where he's wanted on sedition charges for his role in organizing an independence referendum for Catalonia in 2017. He's been living in exile for 4 years. Back in the United States, abortion providers in Texas have asked the Supreme Court to urgently review Texas's new near-total ban on abortions. In their petition, Whole Woman's Health and other groups write, quote, "Texans are in crisis," unquote. The new law bars abortions around 6 weeks into a pregnancy with no exception for rape or incest and allows anyone to sue patients, medical workers, or even a patient's family or friends who aid and abet an abortion, like driving a person to a health clinic. In related news, Republicans in Florida have introduced a similar bill to ban most abortions around 6 weeks. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has subpoenaed 4 close aides and allies to former President Trump: former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and his deputy Dan Scavino, as well as former advisor Steve Bannon and Kash Patel, who at the time was Chief of Staff to the acting Secretary of Defense. Meanwhile, the results from a controversial recount of the presidential vote in Maricopa County, Arizona, has finally ended, and the results are not what Trump supporters were hoping for. The Republican-financed recount found an additional 99 votes for Joseph Biden and 261 fewer votes for Trump. But Trump's effort to overturn the election has not ended. On Thursday, the Office of Texas Secretary of State announced a new audit of election results in Texas's 4 largest counties. This came just hours after a request by Trump to Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin's moving to appeal his 22-and-a-half-year sentence and conviction for murdering George Floyd. In court documents filed Thursday, Chauvin said he intends to appeal on 14 grounds, including the judge's decision not to move the trial out of Hennepin County. In Tennessee, one person died and 14 were injured in a mass shooting at a Kroger supermarket in the town of Collierville Thursday. The shooter was found dead of an apparent self-inflicted wound. And Facebook's global head of safety is set to testify before a Senate panel next week amidst mounting concerns the social media platform can seriously damage young people's mental health. Last week, the Wall Street Journal published a report based on internal Facebook documents revealing its Instagram app makes many adolescent users, particularly teenage girls, feel bad about themselves and can lead them towards harmful content. The report also shows Facebook was aware of the negative impacts of the app, but did not take any action to address the issue. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Delta variant continues to surge across the United States, so too has the housing and eviction crisis. More than 11 million U.S. households are now behind on rent, and studies show about 80% of those being evicted are Black or Latinx, the majority single women with children. Despite data linking evictions to a rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths, the Supreme Court struck down the Biden administration's temporary extension of eviction bans last month. This week, Congressmember Cori Bush and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced the Keeping Renters Safe Act to reinstate the federal pandemic eviction moratorium and give Health and Human Services permanent authority to enact an eviction ban during public health crises. The bill was unveiled at an anti-eviction rally Tuesday outside Congress, led by a delegation of 11 tenants from across the United States who've been evicted or are facing eviction and mounting rental debt. This is Vivian Smith with the Miami Workers Center.
I've been forced to choose between food, rent, too many times. Many of us had to make the choice or the choices between our health,
Vivian Smith and the Tenant Justice Delegation met with Congress members and the Biden administration in D.C. this week. Vivian Smith joins us now from Miami, a single mom who's faced eviction with her children and a leader with the Miami Workers Center. And another member of the Tenant Delegation joins us from Moorhead, Kentucky. Faith Plank is 17 years old, a high school student who faced eviction in March along with her mom and younger sister. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Vivian. We just watched you at that rally. Can you talk about what's happened to you and the significance of Congress passing a bill to reinstate the eviction moratorium?
Good morning. What happened to me was I got evicted trying to pay my rent and see about my kids, eating, health, and I was invited on a trip with me and other tenants all across the world. We came with one purpose, and to make it be clear and known that we need the eviction moratorium and the National Tenant Bill of Rights action put in place so that tenants like me and my tenants that was from all over the walks of different states came together so that Congress Bush can join us as enforcing that we need this eviction moratorium for real tenants like me and my colleagues that joined me on the D.C. Trip to be in effect. You know, we are the people that live in it and we are the people that going through it.
Vivian, at the start of the pandemic, you said you had to quit your job at an Amazon warehouse to avoid getting COVID. How has the pandemic worsened the eviction crisis, especially where you are in Florida and in Miami, which you call a city of renters? Talk about your decision to leave Amazon.
My decision was to better for my health. At the time, the warehouse was getting very infested with the virus. And I chose to just stay home because I didn't want to endanger my kids' health with that. So from staying home, I fell behind in my rent. And I knew that, okay, I have to go back, even if it means risk my health, risk my kids' health. So I did go back to work to come up with the money. And once I came up with the money to go to the rent office, to the landlord now, to present the money and found that I was put in eviction. And that really took me to a whole nother space and a whole nother living another nightmare of not wanting to go back to my car.
So then what happened?
And when I went in to pay the rent, they said, well, Ms. Smith, we can't take it. It was over like $2,000. And they say they can't take $2,000. And I immediately just went to a space where, okay, you know, can you give me my money order back? And I'll try to move with it. I'll try to find somewhere else to move. And then following the next day, she was like, Ms. Smith, you were so upset. But we wanted to talk to you. And then that's the part where I had to pay them to stop the eviction and also pay over $2,000 and some for rent. And that's when I became in contact as a tenant with the Miami Worker Center. And from there, I have been a member and fighting not only for me, but all the other ones that came to D.C., all my fellow members that came to D.C. to join the movement of the eviction moratorium and the National Tenant Bill of Rights to be cleared, to make it clear. That's what we're fighting for. That's what we need, and that's what we want.
Faith Plank, you're also part of this historic delegation that went to Washington working with Congress members in the Biden administration to reinstate the moratorium. You're 17 years old. We are glad we could get you on before you go to high school today. You're from Kentucky. Can you talk about what happened to you and your family?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm actually at high school right now. I was able to find a room to make this call. In March, my entire neighborhood was evicted to make room for a shopping center. I feel the pain of that eviction till this day. Just yesterday morning, I was driving my sister to school, and we sat and cried in my car for 10 minutes. Because she looked over at me and she said three words. She said, "I miss it." We both instantly started sobbing and holding each other's shaking bodies. Because even after 6 months of being evicted, it's still with us. We still feel the pain of that. And I guess that's why it's so important to me that this eviction moratorium is passed through Congress. Because me, along with all of those tenants, have faced an eviction or a pile of rental debt during this pandemic. And with that eviction moratorium being passed, it could have saved my home and it could have saved 75 other families' home in my community.
So you lived in a mobile park, the North Fork Mobile Home Park in Moorhead, for 6 years, paying $125 a month for rent. It's not that you stopped paying rent. It's that they destroyed the mobile home park for this center. So what happened next to you, your sister, and your mom?
We were used to paying $125 in lot rent because we owned our trailer. We were only given 45 days to leave the park, along with 75 other units of affordable housing. And with that comes the source of panic, because in a town that has no affordable housing and a single mom, it's extremely difficult. We were able to find an apartment that we now pay $950 a month for our rent. That is over $800 more than what we were used to paying, and it's almost impossible to make that work.
So your mom works full-time and has to take care of you guys?
Yes, my mom works full-time, and now she's working anywhere from 60 hours a week, as well as I work. Normally, I was working up to 30 hours a week to try to help support my family because of this. Because of school, I can no longer work 30 hours a week, which should never be an issue that a 17-year-old has to face, choosing between work and school because of an eviction that wasn't her fault.
So how does this affect you emotionally, Faith, as a teenager, where you're going to stay the next night when you're in school, when you're with your friends?
I mean, I am still affected emotionally. Every morning as I drive to school, I drive my little sister along with me, and to get from the new apartment to school, we have to drive past what was my home. And when you look up on that hill, it's almost imaginable that that used to be my home, because all you see is dirt and bulldozers. It's now a construction site. And so I have to hold back tears every single day because I have to be strong for my little sister. But once I get to school, I can't hold that in anymore. So I spend a good hour of my first day at school crying, because I can't focus on school when I'm worried about how I'm going to go to bed tonight.
So here you are in Kentucky. You're talking to us from your high school in Moorhead. But last week you were advising White House advisors. What was that like to be part of this delegation to change the law of the United States around evictions?
Gone through similar, and I chaired a meeting with Gene Sperling, who is the American Rescue Plan coordinator for the White House. And at that meeting, I told Mr. Sperling that we know the path to getting a full eviction moratorium passed through Congress is very narrow. And the last time, they didn't have the votes to do it. But we also know that when the White House wants something done, they get it done. And we know that when Gene Sperling wants something done, he gets it done. So my ask to him was to have the American people's back. We need the White House's leadership, and we need his leadership to get this eviction moratorium passed through Congress. And we need to make sure that the White House does everything they can to make sure that's done.
And finally, final words to Vivian Smith in Miami. Cori Bush, the Congress member and the senator, Elizabeth Warren, have introduced this bill for a federal eviction moratorium. What do you say to the American people?
That we went on a mission to make it clear and make it known that the eviction moratorium and the national bill tenants' rights need to be put in effective, like now, like today. And to know that we have Senator Cori Bush behind us, you know, someone that has gone through what I've gone through as a tenant, as a single mother, also what my team that came to D.C., have gone through and are going through. And for people like Faith, that is a 17-year-old that's trying to get her education, you know, and I take my hat off to her because I really care so much for her, meeting her, that her mom and me have a lot in common, because I looked at my daughter every time I dropped her off. And I wanted to know how a 12th grader dealt with sleeping in a car. And knowing that when she get out of school, she got to work with her mom on a second job to about 10 o'clock at night and still try to get up and go to school. So I would say to, you know, Congress and them, that we need that they need to have our back. We need to know that they have our backs in this eviction moratorium and the National Bill of Tenants' Rights. We need it.
We want to thank you, Vivian Smith, for being with us, speaking to us from Miami with the Miami Worker Center, and Faith Plank with Kentucky Tenants, both tenant justice advocates who faced eviction, went to Washington, D.C. in a historic delegation. Faith, thanks so much for joining us from your high school. Next up, the Taliban are already restricting women's rights just after taking over Afghanistan. We'll speak with V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, founder of 1 Billion Rising, who's organized mass actions Saturday to roar and rage for the women of Afghanistan. And we'll hear from a member of the Afghan parliament. She's in hiding. This is an exclusive. Stay with us.
Thank you.
time by Amethyst Key on her chest of glass. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to Afghanistan, where the new Taliban governments closed the Ministry of Women's Affairs that was established soon after the Taliban were toppled in 2001 and replaced it with the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. The Taliban are already restricting women's rights just a month since they overran the capital of Kabul by blocking female students from returning to schools and universities and telling many women workers to stay home. Videos have shown Taliban enforcers flogging women on the streets. Here in the United States, the 1 billion Rising Campaign to End Violence Against Women has called for mass action Saturday to roar and rage for the women in Afghanistan, with activists planning to take to the streets from New York to Los Angeles. For more, we're joined in New York by V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, the playwright and founder of V-Day and 1 Billion Rising. And in Los Angeles, we're joined by Medina Wardak, a mental health social worker of Afghan descent, founder of Burkas and Beer. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! V, why don't you start off by describing the plans for this weekend?
Good morning, Amy, and good morning, Medina. I'm very happy to be here. Our plans are basically, it's a global rising for and with the women of Afghanistan. It was really called for by the women on the ground. We met with them a month ago by Zoom. All of our activists around the world had a long, long 3-hour discussion with them. And we just asked, what can women and men around the world do to support what is going on and support resistance inside the country? And what they said is the most powerful thing we could do is express and show solidarity, rise with the women who are powerful, who need the backing of the world, not through bombs, not through interventions, but through solidarity. And they gave us a list of demands, which are the demands that we are rising for in with them. And what's really thrilling to see is that this has taken off, and there will be risings all over the world, from Bangladesh to the Philippines, all over Africa, in Guatemala, in Madrid, in Italy. So this is really, I really do believe that one of the powers we have right now is to express our global solidarity with the women and with the people of Afghanistan, who have a right to self-determination, and they have had that right for many years and have never been given it.
I wanted to turn to an exclusive interview you did with Belkis Roshan, who has served in the Afghan parliament. Can you tell us about her before we hear a bit of this interview?
Yes, and I'm so happy you're showing this interview, because for me, she is a model of a powerful grassroots woman leader. She is brave. She is outspoken. She was a member of parliament until recently in Afghanistan. She was one of the only, I think she may be the only representative who stood up to say no to the U.S. occupation. She stood up to say no to corruption. She has said no to releasing the Taliban prisoners. And she has really been fighting for years for women suffering in her country. She's from the province of Farah, where she opened and worked in a mental health center, working with the poor and lifting up women. And I have to say, like, she's been a very powerful figure to me. I remember the first time I ever saw her. She was speaking out in the Loya Jirga, the parliament, where she was literally beaten up in the parliament, and she didn't stop talking. Same thing when she went on television. She was beaten up there. She is a fierce defender of democracy, of women's rights, she is an anti-imperialist. She has said from the very beginning that the U.S. occupation would lead exactly where it's led. So I feel very honored and privileged that she spoke to me and did this interview.
And can you tell us where you spoke to her?
I cannot. At this point, her whereabouts are unknown because the security is very high.
Let's go to Belkis Roshan, who served in the Afghan parliament in the Loya Jirga.
The current conditions in Afghanistan, as the world is witnessing, have once again proven our statements were right. The people of Afghanistan have been drowned in yet more misery by the West, led by the U.S. and NATO. They have brought our country to another dark age. Our youth, and especially our women, who make up half of our population, they aren't even considered to be human. They are being eliminated from the society by the Taliban.
Apparently, it's true that the sound of war and bullets and suicide explosions is rather silent, V. But they have enslaved the people in hunger and poverty in a cage named Afghanistan. All the people are living in wretchedness. All of these are consequences of the invasion and operations of the United States, with the mask of democracy and false slogans and promises of freedom for the people and for the women of Afghanistan. They have practically proved to the whole world that they have done nothing except create miseries. They have fulfilled their own imperialistic and capitalist demands by making Afghanistan a war zone to reach its own purposes and to get closer to its competitive aims with Russia and China.
We are rising on September 25th for and with the women of Afghanistan. What do women and men inside Afghanistan need the most from those of us outside?
Our proposition is that these demonstrations and gatherings must not be just for some days, but be constant to force their governments to never recognize the Taliban, and especially not to facilitate the growth of terrorism in Afghanistan more than this. And from those who have sacrificed in any way, our proposition is to not forget the children, women and the oppressed, afflicted people of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been victimized during these 20 years, and now we have been released to the razor blades of the Taliban. We wouldn't say that the foreigners were supposed to protect Afghanistan. It makes me wish they had never come. And if they left, they hadn't brought back the savage Taliban to rule on us.
What are your deepest fears?
The biggest fear for me or any Afghan is probably the possibility of civil wars and the possibility that Afghanistan disintegrate and become the official center for the nourishment of terrorism while the Taliban are in absolute power.
Do you believe there is a resistance growing inside the country?
Indisputably, we believe where there is oppression, there is resistance that will begin and grow against it. The resistance has been initiated by women. Fortunately, this time, women took the lead, and we are hopeful that Afghan women will resist and press till the end and unite for achieving the rights of all. But especially our half of the Afghan population. As we saw, they killed two people in Herat during protest. Even when 20, 30, 50 people protest and demonstrate, this is not tolerated by the Taliban. Of course, for the people of Afghanistan, as we have stated during these 20 years, there is no other alternative but to rise against the various enemies of the Afghanistan themselves. No other country ever brings freedom and prosperity and peace to another country. But there is distinction in every resistance. The resistance that has begun by Ahmad Massoud, with a huge number of warlords on top, is purely for personal and sectarian gains and interests.
How can we build world solidarity?
International solidarity we can initiate just like this right now, by creating harmony and unity and working together, not with governments but the people, especially the victims of 9/11. We request their families to cooperate with us, from the soldiers and all of the people of the countries whose troops were present in Afghanistan. We request them to collaborate with us, not to forget the women, work with them and be their voice. Protest against their own states and specially speak against the lie that for the war and situation in Afghanistan, Biden or Trump or Bush is to be blamed. No, it's the system that is to blame. It's the system which is erroneous, the imperialist system that requires the masses be kept in poverty, misery and war so that they could become bigger capitalists rest and reach their bigger objectives. As we know, the arms industry was very active during this period. More than $2 trillion was spent on the Afghan war. At least $2 trillion went to these corporations. Therefore, we need to establish a foundation or a movement of the victims of this 20-year war, inclusive of both sides, so the countries whose people were victims of this war shall learn from their soldiers and others so that they could prevent the future attacks that U.S. is planning with its allies and NATO. Otherwise, I believe they will attack another country and make their people miserable, just as we witness and experience in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and dozens of other countries that they are intervening in different ways and igniting wars in them, not allowing them to remain in peace.
That's Belkis Roshan. She served in the Afghan parliament, speaking to V, the former Eve Ensler, in an undisclosed location. In fact, V sent the questions, and she then answered them. Medina Wardak is also with us, mental health social worker of Afghan descent, founder of Burqas and Beer, a digital platform, speaking to us from Los Angeles. Medina, if you can wrap up here by talking about what's happening to the women in Afghanistan and also those who have made it into the United States, because you're helping to resettle people who get to the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, what's happened in Afghanistan reverberates across the world. You know, as a mental health social worker, what I have found, especially amongst the Afghan diaspora, is that war will come and find you wherever you are. You know, I was talking to V about this yesterday. My parents watching the television and kind of just seeing everything that's been happening. The mental health impact of the past, not just 20 years of U.S. occupation, but 40 years of intervention in Afghanistan, have created not just a human rights crisis where you see refugees fleeing their country, but also a spiritual and a mental crisis. And what we're seeing is the impacts of war, the pervasive impacts of how it impacts your daily life. And it's just really, really unsettling to see that this could happen. And, you know, just kind of as a social worker of Afghan descent, the resources that we have are so limited. The ability that we have to, you know, really serve these people and help these folks live a life that is full and happy and joyful. I mean, it's really just devastating.
Finally, V, I wanted to ask you about the criticism leveled at Western feminists that their argument for protecting Afghan women was used as a justification for the war and occupation.
Well, I think there were many of us who were very outspoken against the war. And I think I know that because they were gathered in my living room. And I think Medina, you have a very good answer to this question that you said to me yesterday. So I want to give this to you to answer.
Medina Wardak.
Repeat the question.
The question of Western feminists' demand mm-hmm. for the protection of Afghan women was used as a justification for the war and occupation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was having a conversation with V yesterday about my mom's generation. My mom, you know, in Afghanistan was a successful woman who fought really, really hard to be one of the first female accountants in Afghanistan, to be multilingual, to travel the world. And she did that before any foreign invasion, before any foreign intervention. And the stories of Afghan women that I grew up with, about Afghan women being lionesses who don't need anyone, who don't need saving, who never asked for it. And so, you know, growing up in a post 9/11 world and seeing Afghan women painted as such, you know, weak, docile people that need saving, I didn't identify with that because that was not the women of my family. And that's not a lot of Afghan women that I know.
Well, Medina Wardak, I want to thank you for being with us, mental health social worker of Afghan descent, founder of Burkas and Beer, speaking to us from Los Angeles, and V, playwright and founder of V-Day and 1 Billion Rising. The event that they've organized around the world is taking place tomorrow. And next up, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti has resigned in protest over the Biden administration's mass deportation of Haitian asylum seekers days after Border Patrol agents were seen whipping refugees. We'll speak with Congressmember Maxine Waters, longtime advocate for the people of Haiti. Stay with us.
Comme une maladie du ventre qui ne cesse de me ronger. La terre est aussi stérile que mes cris. Mon pays, comme un accouchement qui dure sans enfantement, jamais. Notre mère, ivre gavée de faim, et l'on est dur de cœur, croit dur comme fer, que ses enfants ne vivent que quand elle meurt. Haïti, double démenti au réel et à l'irréel, un abri. Le toit est le ciel. Haïti, imprégné de sel, de soleil et d'un vent qui est satisfait, en fouettant comme le maître. Et il y a dans l'air le mal qui dit que ses enfants ne meurent que parce qu'elle vit.
Haiti, My Country, by Toto Bisanth. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti has resigned in protest over the Biden administration's mass deportation of Haitian asylum seekers. In a letter, the longtime diplomat, Daniel Foote, wrote, quote, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees." Foote also criticized the Biden administration's meddling in Haiti's political affairs, including its support for Ariel Henry as prime minister following the assassination of the Haitian president Jovenel Moïse in July. Foote wrote, quote, "This cycle of international political interventions in Haiti has consistently produced catastrophic results." Foote's resignation came just days after U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback were filmed chasing, grabbing and whipping Haitian asylum seekers who'd gathered in a makeshift camp in Del Rio, Texas. The New York Times reports the Biden administration has now deported nearly 2,000 Haitians in recent days. About 3,000 Haitian asylum seekers remain in the makeshift camps under the International Bridge in Del Rio, while thousands of others have been allowed to stay in the United States. This is Democratic California Congresswoman Maxine Waters, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, longtime advocate for the rights of people in Haiti, speaking outside the Capitol.
What the hell are we doing here? What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again whipping black people, Haitians, into the water where they're scrambling and falling down when all they're trying to do is escape from violence in their country.
That's Maxine Waters. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Democratic California Congresswoman Maxine Waters, chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Can you respond to what we have watched this week, the whipping of Haitian asylum seekers on the U.S. side of the border by U.S. Border Patrol? What are you demanding?
Well, thank you. I am outraged. And I'm demanding that, first of all, they take the cowboys out, take the horses out, and stop using them against the people. Secondly, we've got to come up with real immigration reform. Meanwhile, we've got to treat the Haitians the way the Constitution allows us to have people, you know, petition for amnesty, for to be able to get asylum in our country. We're not allowing them to go through the constitutional process. We're not protecting them in any way. We're not doing what we can to help those who are under that bridge. I mean, this is just inhumane. The United States can do better than this. These deportations, this not allowing them you know, an opportunity to gain entrance into our country is just untoward, and I'm outraged, and this administration can do better than this, and I'm telling them so.
You know, in the last months, the Biden administration granted a new temporary protected status, or TPS designation, to Haitians already living in the U.S. To protect them from deportation for at least 18 months. At the time, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas cited Haiti's political and economic crises, human rights abuses and other security concerns, the pandemic, shortages of food, clean water and health care as reasons for extending the TPS protections for Haitians. In a statement, he said, quote, after careful consideration, we determined we must do what we can to support Haitian nationals in the United States until conditions in Haiti improve so they may safely return home. Now, that was before all of this. But now the Biden administration is blocking the Haitian asylum seekers from entering the United States to apply for refuge and instead mass deporting them. Thousands of them, not to mention the whipping of them. Yesterday, there was breaking news. I thought they were going to say they're going to stop the deportations in line with their previous policy. But instead, they said they won't use the men on horseback whipping the Haitian asylum seekers anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that is a weak response. And I haven't heard from the president. This country hasn't heard from the president. I think he needs to speak up and he needs to articulate what the real policy is, what the humane policy is going to be. You mentioned in your opening that the special envoy quit after having only been, appointed just a few months ago. And he said he was in disagreement with this administration's policy. And I don't think he would have done that unless he understood, having talked with those in the State Department and others, that they have no intentions of doing the right thing by Haiti. And so we're in an awful situation, a situation that we find ourselves in, which adds to the undermining this disrespect, the basically hatred of Haitians, not only by the United States in the way that we have treated them historically, it's also by Canada and France. They have just been the victims of all of these countries for years and taken advantage of and exploited. And they do not intend to have the kind of, well, they, we have not been able to get the United States to support credible governance. They will go along, we will go along with ever, with whomever and whatever happens in Haiti. And so we've got to do better than this. I don't know where this administration is going with this, but I'm going to do everything that I can to prod them. I intend to talk with my workers today. He was absolutely correct in the way that he articulated the policy. I think that is a humane policy that he had articulated, but it doesn't seem to be what they're following.
So I want to ask you about NBC News reporting that the Biden administration's advertising for a new contract to operate a migrant detention facility at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with a requirement that some of the guards speak Spanish and Haitian Creole. A little-known immigrant holding facility on the base has a capacity of 120 people. The contract would allow it to hold, quote, up to 400 migrants in a surge event. As many as 12,000 Haitians were sent to Guantanamo during the George H.W. Bush administration from 91 to 93 when they sought to flee Haiti to seek asylum in Florida. Are we really going to see a reprise of this, Congressmember Waters?
Well, you have more information than I have about that. And if, in fact, that is what is happening, we know what Guantanamo has been used for in the past. I don't know where this administration is going, whether it's talking about continuing to deport and send some to Guantanamo, allow some to come in the United States. I don't know what the policy is.
Hmm. Well, and let me ask you about what the White House is saying. This is Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Question on the Biden administration's ongoing mass deportations of Haitian asylum seekers.
First of all, they're not deportations. People are not coming into the country through legal methods. And again, our policy process has continued to be the same with Haiti as it is for anybody coming through a regular migration across our border.
So if you can respond to this, I saw some Haitians deported back to Haiti, the reason why Ambassador Foote has quit, talking about their hands being shackled to their waist and their feet shackled as well. You couple this with the whippings of Haitians. We've got kids, we've got teenagers into the Rio Grande by these men on horseback. When we saw you in that clip of you outside the Capitol, you were with the Congressional Black Caucus. Had you been to the White House? What is Biden saying? Do you have access to the president at this point?
Well, I'm told there is rumor that somebody in the White House was inquiring about what to do with me. And so I was not invited to the White House. And so, no, I've not had contact with the White House. And I don't know whether anybody at the White House wants to talk with me or whether or not I'm being blocked from going to the White House. They know my history. They know that I fought for Haiti. They know that I was supportive of President Aristide. They know that I helped to rescue him, along with you and others, when we went to the Central African Republic to get him. They know all of this. They know my history. And nobody seems to be talking to me.
Well, Congressmember Waters, I want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we're going to continue to cover this extensively. Congressmember Waters is talking about the 2004 trip. I covered her flying in a small plane with Randall Robinson of TransAfrica and a Jamaican parliamentarian. We flew to the Central African Republic, where President Aristide was flown in a military plane in a coup against Aristide in Haiti by the U.S. military. They brought him back to the Western Hemisphere. You can go to democracynow.org to see the story of that journey and my interview with President Aristide at the time. California Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters, thank you so much for being with us. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, wear a mask, protect the whole community.